The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Thursday, December 2nd, 2010. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. I am, and if you you can look at the Sammy Cam. We don't have audio on it during the show. But I am wearing I'm wearing my new Hanukkah sweater vest. So happy Hanukkah to everyone. I have reverted. This is, I think, the first time I've worn a sweater vest in maybe 30 years. Maybe a little less. Back in high school, I used to wear the sweater vest quite a bit and took a lot of ribbing. There was a lot of Alex P. Keaton comments when I wore this sweater vest back in the day. And that was more of a function, I think, of my high school. It was just, there was no real sense of, like, ideology involved in that. It was just like the sweater vest. I took a lot of grief on the sweater vest. What are you going to do? Just to clarify, yesterday was a complete mess of the day for me in multiple ways. We don't need to get into the details. But be that as it may, I mentioned that I was going to be on Parker Spitzer yesterday. It didn't work out because of events beyond my control. But then later, and people are like, why don't you tell us when you're going to be on television? Then later, I found out that I was asked to go on to Countdown, and Chris Hayes was guest hosting, which was fun because Hayes and we've talked for a long time. And he told me last night, which I did not know, that his first time ever doing radio was on The Majority Report. And I imagine he hadn't done TV before then. So really, I think his first time probably as a sort of a journalist was, in some type of mass media, was on The Majority Report. And that's always nice to hear. And I suggested it was probably the first time I had also been on radio that night, or certainly close. He's gotten much better. I don't seem to have improved that much. Not exactly sure how that works. But we were talking about the Kentucky governor, Beshear, a Democrat, has essentially decreed that the Creation Museum theme park, there's a Creation Museum there now in western Kentucky that was built in 2007, and the same people who founded that, Answers in Genesis, are going to be building a creation theme park, you know, with a Noah's Ark and I guess a Tower of Babel. I don't know. Who knows what kind of Babel? I mean, it's going to be all sorts of dinosaurs walking around with humans. My understanding is that did not work out so well in Jurassic Park. I did not see that movie. But my understanding is that it did not work out so well in that, right? Because the dinosaurs ended up eating the humans. Is that correct?
You didn't see that movie?
No. That's somebody was explaining this to me. I didn't see it. And then somebody told me that the Costa Rican Air Force had to bomb them.
That might have been the later sequels. I didn't watch those.
I didn't see it. If they stream it on Netflix, I will watch it. Probably not.
No, you won't.
I won't. But I mean, I'll maybe. If Milo was a boy, I would. Because boys that age seem to be obsessed with dinosaurs. I guess, though, you don't want to show the kid that the dinosaur is going to eat you. So I went on to Countdown to discuss this. Essentially, the tax incentive is they build the theme park, and I have no problem with that. I have more of a problem with the museum than I do the theme park. at least the theme park, you could say, like, oh, look, there's Mickey Mouse, right, and there's dinosaurs walking around with people. That's when it makes sense. There's Noah's Ark, yes, and there's Magic Mountain Ride. That makes sense. A museum? No. You know, unless it's like a museum full of silly things that people... No. The Kentucky state has a program to incentivize tourism, and apparently what they do is they give back 25% of the sales tax collected at the theme park, up to 25% of the cost of developing it. So in this case, it could be up to $37 million over the course of 10 years. I don't know if I really have a problem with it from a discrimination standpoint, from a constitutional standpoint. I had mentioned on to Chris Hayes that the only thing that could possibly arise, in my estimation, would be that if you could prove that really only a Christian theme park is eligible for this subsidy because a other religious theme park, a Jewish theme park, a Hindu theme park, a Muslim theme park, could never raise the revenue that would make it, would make this tax incentive accessible to it, on and on and on. And then the other issue is that they may not be able to discriminate in the same way that they discriminate in the hiring of their, at their creation museum. So with all this said, I recalled that years ago, I called the Creation Museum, and I dug up the audio from this phone call back in the day when I used to make these calls, and I'll start doing it again when we get a phone. I just need to figure out how to do a phone. And it was pretty funny. I mean, I listened to the 25-minute version of this phone call, which we condensed down to about 3.5 minutes. Now, it didn't cut it to make the guy seem, you know, bad. You should know this right off the bat, that we didn't need to do that. Because, you know, in his world, what he is saying is perfectly rational. And what I am saying is completely insane. And so he thinks he is making fun of me. And, you know, I never call without telling people that I'm going to, it's for broadcast. And so by the end of the conversation, you know, he had said something like, are you going to play this whole thing? It's 25 minutes long. I got to tell you, Sam, you're going to come off as being very obnoxious. And so I don't know if that's actually part of this clip. But let's play this clip. And just so you know, this clip we will post on our YouTube channel. So if you want to pass it around to other people, it's only 3.5 minutes long. And ultimately, we will make an extended version available for members only in one of our famous, soon-to-be-famous, in the future fame. Right? Is that the best way to express that? Future fame? Way. Our future famous CDs for members only. Okay, let's play this.
This is Mark. May I help you?
Yeah, hi, Mark. It's Sam Cedar calling from the Majority Report. I just wanted to ask, just to find out what the Creation Museum was all about.
It's being built by Answers in Genesis. We're a Bible-defending organization. It will be a walk through history, according to the Bible, but along the way, we'll expose some of those grave problems with evolution theory. When you're talking about things that have occurred in the unobservable past, you're getting outside of observational science and dealing with historical things. And you have to...
You understand there is a distinction. They're making it between observational and what they call historical science. But here's the problem with their whole notion of historical science as it comes up. How do they know there were dinosaurs? I mean, they claim that dinosaurs walked the earth at the same time as humans. How do they know there's dinosaurs? They're using that evil historical science again. All right, go ahead.
And dealing with historical things. And you have to interpret evidence that we might dig up in the ground today. It doesn't say it's 5.5 million years old.
So, for instance, carbon dating, you could look to the Bible for a solution as opposed to the way that scientists...
Evolutions don't use carbon dating to date dinosaur fossils, for example.
What do they do?
Well, they don't use carbon dating for that. They use other dating methods which have built-in assumptions and fudge factors. And,
for example...
Yeah. Well, at this point, I defer to one of our scientists who has a PhD.
I understand. So what is the Christian version of why the dinosaurs aren't around anymore?
All right. But this is our model. This is our best guess. You know, you don't have scientific proof for the disappearance of dinosaurs. In fact, there are even some evolutionists today, one at the University of Chicago, who believes there's a dinosaur even in Africa today. We think that after a worldwide cataclysmic flood, the climate changed, less vegetation, people hunting dinosaurs, that they, over the years, started perishing, probably 4,000 years ago. We have dragon legends around the world. We have the country flag of Wales that has a dragon on it. We have pictographs in Utah.
All right, pause this for one second. Did you hear what he said? Dinosaurs were around 4,000 years ago. 4,000 years ago. The proof? Why is there a dragon on the flag of of Wales? There you go. That's called observational proof, folks. Observational science, not historical science.
Graphs in Utah of dinosaur-like creatures. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of evidence that dinosaurs have been around recently.
From your perspective, how old is the Earth?
When the museum opens, we will take a position that the Earth is young. It's certainly not millions or billions of years old.
Between 5 and 10,000 years old?
Yes. We can't prove that. I mean, again, we're dealing with historical science as opposed to observational science.
When did humans show up?
Just after the dinosaurs, the sixth day of creation. That's our belief. We believe the best facts of science, when best interpreted, support that dinosaurs and humans have been contemporaneous.
Do you think that the Bible should also be our blueprint for other aspects of our lives?
In many aspects, sure.
I can't give you necessarily specifics in the Bible, but I do know that it says that women should be stoned during...
If you don't have specifics, I can't...
In Leviticus it says that women should be stoned during that time of the month.
Well, then you've got to speak to someone else on our staff who can better address that.
I mean, you know some of this stuff too, right?
Yeah.
You don't feel comfortable talking about it?
That's not the point.
But, I mean, it guides your life.
Hey, Sam, you're starting to be on the abrasive side.
Well, yeah, I've been told that before.
Oh.
I think, yeah.
So what are your religious beliefs? Do you have a philosophical problem with survival of the fittest and animals killing each other over millions of years, according to the evolution story, and God is behind that? It's just philosophically absurd.
Well, why would would an all-loving God say that if a woman have an issue, be blood?
Oh,
I mean, it's 15:19. It's Leviticus. I mean, I didn't write it. God did. Everything in the Bible is written by God, right?
Yeah, and answersingenesis.org can answer more of your questions if you want that, or speak to Ken Ham on Monday. Okay. Hey, Sam, thanks.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate the
time. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The longer one is actually pretty good, too. You know, when I start to ask him, like, why... Well, first of all, the notion of, like, how can you philosophically accept the idea of evolution? How can I philosophically accept it? I don't know. I can't philosophically accept the fact that it rains either. I mean, what am I supposed to do about that? It's not like, I'm sorry. My philosophy does not dictate what has happened in terms of the evolution of human beings or any other species, for that matter. My philosophy doesn't dictate whether or not the sun shows up, or it rains, or my daughter's a jerk in the morning, or not. And my philosophy doesn't make a difference. But I ask, well, how is it? How can an all-loving God? What about genocide? Well, that's because of a man's sin. And so it's fascinating. And we will post that. Before we bring our guest, we're going to be talking. Well, you know what? We got to go to our guest. Let's take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk to David Dyan of Fire Dog Lake. He's going to give us a rundown. There was a huge audit dump, essentially, from the Fed. This was a function of a law that was passed. We talked about with Jane Hampshire. This is one of those things. She reached across her transpartisan, actions and brought about this audit of the Fed, which I think is it's disturbing, but also much needed. We're going to talk to Dave Dionne about it. We'll be back in just a minute. This is the Majority Report. All right, we're back. Sam Seder, this is the Majority Report. Want to welcome to the show a guy who has really become one of my favorite bloggers. And used to read him on Digby's blog at Hubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubbubb And at one point, I think we had you guest blogging on the Air America site. And now he's... I'll tell you something. I could literally do my whole show by just reading his blog at Fire Dog Lake. It would be unfair, because at one point he'd catch on, and then he'd be upset that all I'm doing is just regurgitating his material. But I could do that if I wanted to. He's the news editor, journalist, all of it at Fire Dog Lake News. David Dayan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam. I appreciate it.
And now, of course, there's a little known trivia question that you and I question. I don't even think it's a question because no one would even think to ask.
no one would ever know that.
And probably almost as many people would care. But we did a student film together in Ann Arbor, Michigan, like 18 years ago.
Yeah, it was my senior year, and we had a mutual friend, and you were brought out from New York, I guess?
Massachusetts, actually.
Massachusetts, to star in this film, and I was just sort of laying around in Ann Arbor during my senior year, trying to do as little as possible. And, we spent a couple days up there, and then I think 15 years later, we realized we were talking about the exact same things with respect to politics, and met up again.
Very funny. But in the meantime, you've been I can't tell you enough how much I enjoy your blogging and your news reporting, and because you do both. And by blogging, I'm talking almost like sort of you analyze as you report, but you report in a way that you seem to have more hours in the day than normal human beings do. I don't know how you manage to swing that, but
that is what my wife believes.
And that's even shocking to me that you're married. I don't understand how your wife lets you do this.
Yeah, she sometimes doesn't believe it either, I think. I burn the midnight oil a lot. I think that's how it gets done, and do things while she's asleep.
Well, for God's sakes, don't have a child, please, because we can't afford to lose you to a child. All right, so be that as it may. We had this big, big Fed audit dump yesterday. First, I just briefly touched on it, but tell us how this came about. What legislation passed, what it is that we're looking at, and then what are you starting to see in this audit dump?
Okay. Well, how it came about is this was mandated by the Dodd-Frank Financial Regulatory Reform Bill. One of the provisions in Dodd-Frank was to force the Federal Reserve to disclose all the recipients of their emergency lending during the worst parts of the financial crisis, basically from 2007 onward. This was something that was a transpartisan coalition kind of built up around this in the House between Ron Paul and Alan Grayson. They worked on getting this. It was popularly known as the Audit the Fed provision. They got this done in the House, and eventually Bernie Sanders spearheaded this in the Senate. It's somewhat limited, but it's a pretty expansive amount of information from an entity that is usually quite secretive about who they lend to and for what purpose. So this is a real insight into what the Fed was doing during the most the biggest crisis point since the Depression. And as you say, some of what we're learning is pretty startling.
Now, publicly, what we were told is there's going to be this TARP, Troubled Assets Relief Program.
Right.
I mean, nobody's even talks about it, you know, what it actually means anymore. I don't know if I've heard anybody actually spell it out in ages, but... And we were told this thing involved like $700 billion, and now we're told, hey, we're making the money back. So the whole bank bailout thing was a net positive for the American public. As succinctly as you can, tell us why this is a bunch of crap and how this Fed audit manifests that.
Right. Well, this is ridiculous for a number of reasons. You know, and number one being... What we see in this Fed audit is that the $700 billion pledged through TARP, and not all of it was even used, is a pittance of what banks and financial corporations were able to get from the government at that time. I mean, in this Fed audit, we see $3.3 trillion in emergency lending. That dwarfs the $700 billion that was pledged through TARP, and there are other facilities as well. We just learned that Fannie and Freddie, who are the government-sponsored entities who purchase mortgage-backed securities, they're going to double the amount of money they're going to tap the government for, and that's all losses. So, you know, the idea of just using TARP as the barometer of you know, and treating it as an investment program rather than what it was. Is some creative accounting. In addition, the way that TARP was getting repaid was that the Federal Reserve was giving out money for free, practically, and the banks were then either investing it in higher yield bonds from the government, which were golden and backed, and doing through what they call the carry trade, paying back TARP.
Right, so let me make that clear to everybody.
Money from one place to the other.
Let's make this clear. What we were doing is we were lending to the banks at less than 1% interest, and then they were turning around and lending it back to us at 3 or 4% interest, and then saying, look,
actually,
we've got the money. We've made money. And so we basically, it's just another way of giving them money.
What we're learning from this Fed audit is that some of the interest rates were as low as 0.0078%.
You got to be a real genius to make money when you're getting it for 0.0078%. Literally, I don't know what you – there's almost no place you couldn't put your money to get a higher return than that.
That's correct.
And when you're talking
about my little CD that I have,
right,
I get a slightly higher return than 0.0078%.
I think my checking account gives me a better a return on that.
I think it's $1.50 a month I get out of my checking account.
Right, exactly. And if we were to walk down to our bank and say, like, oh, someone just loaned me $1.3 trillion.
Right.
I'm going to deposit it in my checking account. I'll see you in 2 months. Was this money that was loaned to them, the $3.3 trillion loaned in emergency lending, has that money been paid back, or?
Well, I mean, to an extent. The Federal Reserve's alibi here is that, you know, we did what we had to do. This was a crisis point, and look at this. We made money in the last 2 years, so everybody shut up. And this elides several different things. You know, number one, it's not necessarily the side of the ledger, whether it's positive or minus, that's the point here. The point is that banks and large financial companies and even just regular corporations were accessing this money, as well as foreign banks, were able to get low or no interest loans using collateral that was literally junk, in total junk bonds that they were giving off as collateral for these loans, which is the opposite of what you and I would have to do if we were, you know, trying to get a loan from a bank.
Right.
We would have to put something real like our house up as collateral. We would have to pay a significant interest rate. And in the end, that would be a moneymaker for the banks. The Fed is saying, you know, we're going to give this money away. It's going to be secret so that, if banks didn't want people to know that they were so insolvent that they were trying to access this money all the time, trillions of dollars, that they wouldn't know about it. And they were able to do it in such a way that allowed them to put up crappy loans as collateral.
All right, well, David, let me ask you this. Let me stop you here for a second, because I really want to break this down.
Okay.
So what we've lost in terms of what essentially the taxpayer has funded here is the cost of money insofar as money was lent out at virtually no interest.
Right.
The cost of money coming the other direction in that we then borrowed that money back from the money we lent them, borrowed that back for 3 or 4% interest. So
right.
That's a figure. And has anybody broken down what that number is? Now, this is aside from the issue that we also assumed responsibility, I guess, through Fannie and Freddie for a bunch of really horrible loans.
Right, and we're losing hundreds of billions of dollars on that deal. And that has to be factored into any assessment of whether this was a positive or negative situation for the U.S. government.
So has anybody come up with that figure? I mean, is there any way to even know? Because we don't necessarily have the ability to know who took the money that we lent them at virtually 0% interest and came back and loaned it back to us in the form of buying treasury bonds. I mean, do we?
Right. I mean, it's hard to know because every time you see any kind of accounting of this, it's done in a very circumscribed way. They only, count one part of the bailout, or they only count one part of this or that. But I want to bring up one other very important thing here. You know, this money was lent out because the markets had seized up, nobody was lending to each other, and this was a crisis, and what the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government believed is that this was a crisis of liquidity, and we had to get money into the system so that the system would function. Well, I mean, what we figured out over the last 2 years, when we've seen a stagnation of the entire economy, millions of people out of work with practically no hope, is that this had nothing to do with liquidity. This is about insolvent banks who are still insolvent, who are still failing to lend at any decent clip, who are still, unable to really show whether or not they're solvent without accounting tricks. And, you know, the entire point of the TARP was to fix the financial system. It wasn't just to prop up a bad financial system. And I think that's what this shows, is that it needed so much money just to basically survive and not completely go under, but we still haven't fixed the problem.
Okay, so I just want to make sure people understand the difference here between a liquidity and an insolvency issue. The liquidity issue implies that the banks have all their money tied up in loans, that they actually have assets in the form of these loans that will ultimately pay off down the road, but at the moment they don't have cash to run their operations, essentially. That would be a liquidity situation. An insolvency would be that these loans, in fact, are never going to pay off. That it's like everybody loaned their money to Dorsey and are waiting for Dorsey, who works in the office, to pay them off, and it's never going to come. And so
And then you make an accounting statement that says, well, in 10 years, Dorsey's going to pay off, so let's just keep lending me this money to fix my little short-term problem for 10 years or for however amount of time. But surely,
and then you wait and pray that Dorsey marries some rich girl or something, and can pay off his bills. But that's not happening unless he starts.
I mean, this is known as extend and pretend. This is known as you extend out the period where the banks have to make a reckoning, and you pretend that they're real banks, but they're not. They're zombie banks.
So we have these zombie banks, and this is obviously problematic because they can't restart the economy. We just keep pouring money into these banks. And we also, one of the other problems with this whole thing is that we got nothing in return. We got no say in terms of their behavior. We got very little in terms of new regulations to prevent this from happening in the future. And Now, what if we had followed? There's another end to this too. Is what they are doing on the foreclosure side? And I want to go to there in a minute. But I recently saw a story that Iceland essentially didn't bail out their banks, at least to the tune that we did, or in the same dynamic, allowed some of these banks to fail and is slowly recuperating in a much better way than, say, Ireland is. What would have happened if we let a couple of these banks go under?
Well, I mean, I think what the Fed would tell you is that we did try that with Lehman Brothers, and it caused this giant shock to the system. But that's really a fake argument, I think. You know, what we could have done is, as you say, you're talking about attaching strings. There was a way to, you know, effectively nationalize these banks, to get the horrible loans off the books, to share the pain here, because right now it's falling all on essentially us, rather than forcing the bondholders, forcing the executives of the banks out, making them, you know, take a haircut, as it were.
Now,
and
by that,
having everyone recognize their losses here,
right,
but
let's explain
doing that.
Right. Okay. So let's explain what that means with the bondholders taking a haircut. In that instance, what it is right now what we're doing is we're paying for these crappy loans, these bundles of crappy loans. Paying a dollar to a dollar, 100 cents on the dollar. And so that these guys get their full benefit as if these were not crappy loans. And instead, what you're suggesting is we should have come in and said, okay, everybody's going to lose here. We need to salvage the banking system, fine. But if you have one of these bundles of crappy loans, guess what? We're only going to give you 50 cents on the dollar for this. You're going to eat some of the losses. But we're going to eat some of the losses too, because we know this is what government does in a time of crisis. But everybody's going to have to share the pain. That's what you're suggesting we could have done.
That's what we could have done. And as a result of not doing that, I mean, all of this gets back to accepting reality. And the reality is that the banks made a bunch of loans that nobody could ever have paid. They are unable to recoup the investment here. And, you know, the losses, frankly, would wipe out a lot of the capital that these banks have held up. So you can recognize that reality and work to deal with it in the way that you, similar to what you described. Or you could deny reality, make it unable for your regulators to even function, because any disruption that would cause any pain for the banks is going to be immediately met by, well, that would make us insolvent and that would be a problem. I mean, this is essentially the issue of too big to fail that you hear over and over again. You put your entire regulatory system for the banks in a vice because they're not able to really do anything lest they find the banks insolvent. And ultimately, the costs of that are borne by the greater economy and you and me.
So the amount of money we've put in is essentially the equivalent of like keeping a comatose person alive, essentially. And they are pretending this person's alive when in fact they're really dead. But we're juicing enough whatever it is into their system to make it look like they still have a heartbeat. And so what is it forcing them to do on the foreclosure side? Because now it's almost like incentivizing their fraud on the foreclosure side.
Right. I mean, and this, if I had 2 hours, I could explain the entire foreclosure issue, but I'll try to make it short.
It is a podcast.
Essentially, you, again, have a bunch of loans that are bad, that the banks do not want to realize a loss on. And there's a related issue that they did all the paperwork wrong and probably don't even own these loans or don't have the standing to foreclose on these houses because they did not properly
securitize the loan. Let's touch on that in a minute. But
I'll put that aside.
Okay.
So what they do is they want to get out from under these loans, but they don't want to realize the loss on their books. So they rush to foreclose, and there's an issue of that This is an incentive of the servicers who are affiliated with the big banks but aren't the banks themselves. They rush to foreclose, but they never sell the home. They essentially take it off the market and create this thing called shadow inventory so that they don't have to immediately realize the loss on their books.
So this
if
is
they
just
modified the loans and let people stay in the home, they would have to realize that loss immediately, and that's a big thing that the banks don't want to
do. So, again, this is just an accounting trick, which is the equivalent of, you know, hooking a dead body up to a car battery and saying, look, it's twitching. It's alive.
Yeah, that's a pretty apt metaphor, I would say.
And then there's this other issue of MERS, which is we've talked about on the show. It was an electronic system that was set up to facilitate the transfer of these mortgages from the servicer, the original loaner, to somebody who bought the loan as a security, to another person who bought the loan as a security, and so on, so on, so on. And
right.
The law has always been that every time you transfer one of these loans, you must record it down at City Hall or the Register of Deeds, in your town.
Yeah,
maybe your county, I guess, and yeah. But they the banks essentially got together and said we could just do this electronically and save all the money for these fees.
Right.
But
I mean, MERS was set up as a massive tax evasion strategy. It was a way for the banks to get out from under these recording fees, which are nominal. They're about $30 a transfer, but as you said, they were doing millions and millions and millions of transfers at this time, so the money adds up. The banks own MERS. They created MERS. MERS has no employees. It's just a database, essentially, and yet it is listed as the mortgagee of record in 60 million loans across
wow.
the country. And that's just one trade. You know, obviously these things get traded over and over. So that brings up major legal issues about whether MERS has standing to foreclose, and it also brings up whether the banks conspired to essentially evade these recording fees and deprive local governments of money that they're owed.
Now, this is interesting because, I spoke to Taibbi last week and to Atrios, and we brought up the idea of, like, why aren't these municipalities, counties suing the people behind MERS for evading these fees. And
right.
The first case seems to be potentially happening in Massachusetts,
right.
where a local registrar has asked Martha Coakley, who is the attorney general there, to look into this. Now, my dad's an attorney in Massachusetts. He doesn't focus on real estate law, but according to him, it is not... You are not legally obligated to record these transfers with the registrar. However, if you go into court, it is really the only way you can prove that you are the rightful owner.
Correct.
And so it's really more of an issue for those people who are being foreclosed. Conceivably, if there was enough people who were savvy about this, they could stop a huge percentage of the foreclosures in this country by simply saying to the bank, you don't own, or whoever it is comes in, you don't own the mortgage.
Do you know how they do this? I mean, MERS gets listed as the mortgagee. In other words, they're the ones that have standing to foreclose. MERS does make the initial, you know, they're listed on the payment of the initial recording fee when the house transfers the first time. And so they say, we're MERS. But MERS has no employees, right? So here's what they do. They allow any bank who wants to foreclose and services the loan to go on their website and apply for any member of their company to become a vice president of MERS. And then MERS does an action where they endow someone to be the vice president of the company. There are over 20,000 vice presidents or assistant secretaries of MERS in this country, even though they get no benefits, they get no salary, They are not affiliated with MERS in any way. They are just handing over their company imprimatur to any member bank that that essentially wants it. This is their workaround for this. They even sell
Dude,
their
we have got
and
to
their
corner
letterhead
the
for 25 bucks on their website.
We have got to corner the Cafe Press market on creating fake MERS cards. I smell huge money-making meme here. MERS T-shirts. I became a vice president of MERS. All I got was this lousy T-shirt.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's pretty...
But you're right about this. I mean, this is a huge legal mess, this issue. And the lawsuits are working their way up through state courts with mixed results. And this is a state issue. This isn't really a federal issue. I know there's a lot of hyperventilating that there's going to be some MERS whitewash bill or something out there. But it's an issue for state courts, and states have approached it in different ways. There are at least three state Supreme Courts that have ruled in individual cases that MERS does not have standing to foreclose because they simply aren't the mortgagee. They say this different things in the same, you know, in the same case. They say we're an agent and we have no financial stake in the loan, but we're the mortgagee and we have the right to foreclose. So, you know, there's no kind of consistency there. It's a slow, agonizing process to work its way through the courts, but I do support what they're trying to do, this guy in Massachusetts in Essex County.
Right.
Because, you know, it's simply common sense. They're evading multiple recording fees based on transfers of these individual loans.
Right, and at the very least, it's going to provide some type of precedent and some type of established principle that none of these, you know, she investigates this, she's going to come with some conclusion. It may not be that you're due this money, but it could be we're going to invalidate any loan that comes in that hasn't gotten these recording fees.
Right, and that's about 60% of the loans in the United States Wow. which have been securitized and use the MERS system.
Wow. I have one more question. We've held you
Sure.
Longer than I said, and I appreciate your hanging out.
No problem.
There was one story in McClatchy that the Fed has made a proposal to amend a provision of the Federal Truth in Lending Act. Apparently, it's a 42-year-old provision
Yeah.
that essentially says that homeowners have the right to cancel or rescind illegal loans for up to 3 years after the transaction is completed if the buyer wasn't provided with proper disclosure at the time of closing. So essentially, people go into the foreclosures, they get a lawyer who looks over the loan and finds that the loan did not disclose things it should have disclosed, and it allows them to sell the house and pay off the loan without being foreclosed.
Right.
Because it's very hard for you to sell. I think it's maybe impossible to sell a house that has a lien on it. And
yeah.
The Fed wants to essentially say, okay, first you put the lien on it, then you let them sell the house, and then they can pay it off. Well, in practice, nobody can ever do that. Does the Fed get to change these rules? I mean, how does the Fed...
Well, they certainly think they can. And, you know, but this is all in service to burying the evidence. I mean, we have evidence that there were major errors and outright fraud, criminality in the origination process when these loans were originated. Just outright criminality. Where, you know, for example, they would have someone sign a bunch of disclosure agreements, and the real loan would be at the bottom of the stack, and a fake loan would be at the top of the stack, and then they just rip off the top of the stack, and voila, you signed a loan that you didn't think you signed. I mean, that literally happened. You know, there's massive fraud in that origination process. There is massive fraud and errors in the securitization process that makes questionable whether there is clear title on a great deal of these loans. They did not securitize.
All right, well, I get this.
Properly.
So the Fed's trying to
bury the bodies. They're trying to bury the evidence. Let's remove as many obstacles as possible to foreclosing so that these loans can essentially be thrown out the window.
But I don't understand who the Fed proposes this to. To Congress? The Congress is supposed to change this law?
I believe it's a rulemaking thing where the Fed believes that since they still at this point, until the Consumer Financial Protection Agency gets into place, they still run consumer protection. They're still the regulators, you know, that are responsible for it. And, you know, whether they invalidate the law or not, they could just choose not to regulate in that area, and then there you go. I mean, you know, if you take the police force away, then what
right,
the law
but,
is
I mean,
doesn't really matter.
I guess the real question is, though, will it still be a tool for homeowners who are being foreclosed in courts?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I haven't read a ton about this. I've read a little bit. There was a New York Times editorial on this a couple days ago. You know, it may not be able to be a tool, but you run into this weird thing between state regulations and federal regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, homeowners have any of 100 different ways to challenge these foreclosures. What they need is the expertise of someone who's seen all of these games that have been run,
right.
and they need solid and serious representation.
Right.
And
it's the same dynamic as somebody who goes into one of these loans. You know, these things are so intricate and so complicated that more often than not, people don't have the resources.
Absolutely.
Or frankly,
there's an information and resource asymmetry because the banks have all kinds of high-powered lawyers, and homeowners, if they had the money to afford a lawyer who would deal with this problem for them, they'd probably pay off the home.
Right.
So, you know, they're just at a major disadvantage. There are legal aid societies and pro bono lawyers who are doing incredible work, but they can't do it forever. You know, if you have a few extra bucks, find your legal aid society in your area and give them some money. You know, every additional lawyer they can hire is several more homes that can be saved. I think that, you know, there are several things that are troubling the banks with respect to this foreclosure fraud issue. One of them is the courts. I mean, we can really see some changes here if we get enough lawyers who are good enough at spotting these problems. They already, you know, caused this temporary issue with the robo-signing. That's who discovered it. It was pro bono lawyers, essentially.
Dave Dan,
you know, that is one of the major ways that we're going to get some accountability on this.
Dave Dan from Fire Dog Lake News, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your crystal clear explanations of this stuff. Very helpful.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate it. Thanks
All right,
for
we'll talk
me
to you soon.
All right, bye.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this. All right, we're back. David Dan, just a great blogger, and he writes with the same clarity in which he talks, frankly. And I honestly don't know how he does it. Now, I got an email from one of our professional leftists, Tom Kay. And he was forwarding one of these crazy, you know, this one's from Town Hall, a more traditional conservative email, you know, site, saying that, you know, Barack Obama has already banned nearly a million American-made rifles? Barack Obama is coming for your guns. Now, of course, you got to dig into it a little more to find out that basically what it is they've said that a million M1 Garand carbine rifles stored in South Korea for the past 60 years cannot be reimported into this country. The State Department doesn't want these things running around.
And that's based on a ban that's pre-Obama.
Right, of course. Of course it is. And so you get this sort of incredible sort of like mixture of semi-fact. There are M1 guns. There are maybe a million of them in South Korea. And then there's also Barack Obama. And then Barack Obama's trying to keep a million guns away from Americans. And I have this other nut job who keeps emailing me. And she is someone who has been emailing me for years because I went back and searched her name in my email files. And it was, you know, Barack Obama's a Manchurian candidate. Barack Obama was born in Kenya. Barack Obama, And it just goes on and on and on. And some of the things she writes, like, you know, the bankers are screwing us. Yes, I agree. The bankers are screwing us. And they're part of a one-world cabal. And they're all orchestrating this thing. And then I just get email after email. Death panels are coming. Through Obama. Obama's godfather is George Soros. George Soros planted Obama years ago to come in and continue his program of destroying America. The USDA looks to illegally approve GE sugar beet planting again. The government is taking over our food supply. And you start to see that everything she's saying, you know, comes from some combination of Glenn Beck and Alex Jones. And Alex Jones, I've watched his show. On occasion, you stumble across these things. And he's in there, again, with this part of what he's saying is legitimate. The bankers are ripping us off. They've been got $4 trillion and you know, or 4.000 you know, whatever the figure is. And it's all being engineered to turn us into slaves. It's all being engineered to shear the sheep, he says, to cull the herd. And I'll tell you something. I'll tell you what's really dangerous about this. Is that, one, this fantasy notion that there's some cabal that is doing... No, this is not a cabal of bankers who are engineering this implosion of the financial system to control the populace. No, it's a bunch of guys trying to make money and don't give a crap about the rest of us. And so they're willing to put anything out there, which is also a perfect explanation of Alex Jones. He's perfectly willing to tell his followers to create some fictionalized notion of the reality that is about us. Of the reality that we are getting ripped off by the bankers. But it's not because they're in some secret cabal and they want to shear the sheep. It's simply because they're greedy and they don't care about anybody else. In fact, if the bankers could actually organize themselves in such a way to orchestrate something like this, rather than it being a series of individuals who are simply following their own self-interest without any regard to ethics or to other people's liabilities, if there was actually a little cabal that was engineering this, guess what they do? They would create Alex Jones. They would pay Alex Jones. They would fund Alex Jones. They would build his studio. They would buy his movies. They would do all this so they could send all of Alex Jones' followers down a wormhole, believing that there is one world cabal here that is using Agenda 21 of the UN to cull the herd, to control everyone. These bankers don't want control of the world population. Are you kidding me? What a pain in the ass that would be. They just want to make as much money as possible. They could give fuck all about the rest of the people. Honestly, who wants to control the whole world when they're just already making money as it is? People don't want to just control this because, well, it's our agenda. We've been engineering this entire meltdown for years. No, they're seeing an opportunity that they may have created accidentally, and they're taking advantage of it, which is also a perfect description of people like Alex Jones. Hey, there's a financial meltdown. I'm going to take advantage of this thing. This is good. Because then I can get on and say, this is secret information. No one has this information. Except, of course, the big Fed audit dump. How did that happen? How could there be an audit dump? I mean, these world leaders have the ability, the foresight to engineer all this, and they didn't see, like, hey, you know, maybe we should have bought off a couple of senators more than we did. Excuse me? And they're all turning us into slaves? You want to know who the slaves are? Look at your clothes. It was probably some, child worker in China who made my sweater, for God's sakes. You want to worry about slavery? Go look at what's happening in China or in India or in the Philippines. I mean, it's ridiculous. These people just want some notion that they know the secret information that is going to unlock everything. You don't need secret information. It's quite obvious what's happening. The difficult part is finding a solution. And I can tell you, it may be trying to figure out campaign finance reform. It may be creating a third party. I don't know what it is. But I can tell you what the solution is not. I can tell you what is actually driving you in the absolute opposite direction of a solution. And that is to think that there's some type of secret cabal that's engineering all of this, and that if you watch some guy on the internet, he's going to tell you the secret information that's going to unlock all of it, and if you send around email chains, everybody will be safe. No, that's not going to happen. And neither will helping you buy freeze-dried food. It'll help you if you sell freeze-dried food, but it's not going to help you if you buy it. I'm sorry. That's the truth. And so this lady is sending me these emails, and it's just, you know. And one of them, of course, was Larry the Cable Guy. Mixed in with, Krugman's talking about death panels. Yes. There's going to have to be cost controls. Does that mean that people are going to be unplugged? No, because I get news for you. Grandma can't afford the care that would not be paid for by Medicare anyways. We already have death panels. They're called insurance companies. And they decide whether or not you can get medication for certain things that I can assure you. Medicare is far more apt to pay for. And what creating cost controls will also do is change the nature of our medicine from one that is procedure-based to one that is more holistic, I guess. You know, read Maggie Mahara's Money-Driven Medicine. Read that story by Atul Gawande in The New Yorker about comparing two towns in Texas and why everything is the same, including death rates and health indexes and everything. Except for in one town, it costs 30% more health care. Read that study from Dartmouth. Don't send stupid emails. And think that you're doing something. The sky is falling. No, the sky's not falling. Yes, we're getting ripped off by bankers. No, they're not in one padded room somewhere pulling the strings. They're just sitting in their offices going, how can I make more money today? And I don't give a shit who this hurts. How can I make more money today? They're not even thinking, I don't give a shit who this hurts. That doesn't come into their minds. Not even enough to reject the idea. It's just like, how much money can I make today? What am I allowed to do without going to prison? Or rather, I should say, what am I allowed to do in terms of my not getting caught doing it that will make me more money? That's the secret. And the thing that's shrouded in mystery is, how do we fix this system? Unbelievable. All right, got a bunch more stories. Gonna have to get to them tomorrow. Tomorrow's Casual Friday. I could spend the whole time talking to David Dayan. Folks, let me do my Alex Jones thing here. Send me money. Send me money, or bad things will happen to you. Bad things. Evil things. You don't have freeze-dried food, do you? No. Oh, here's my point about Alex Jones. There you go. And what was my other new one?
You are a douchebag.
I could tell when Dorsey's like streaming the show as opposed to listening to the show off the board, because he reacts like 20 seconds later to, you are a douchebag. Folks, if you can afford it, become a member at MajorityReporter.fm or Majority.fm or MajorityReportRadio.com. They all point you to one site. Hit, click, become a member, and become a member. Support the show. Keep us around. Someday we're gonna be going, moving to the $2 lunch. Your support keeps us alive, period. I could take money from major corporations like Evans Hat Emporium or Dorsey's Used Cable Box Sales, but I don't. we do actually take money from JustCoffee.coop, and if you go there, you can get 10% off great-tasting coffee that is produced and where everyone who works on it is compensated properly. Our favorite in the Cedar household, Los Diosas. Los Diosas. I've gotten my instructions from my wife. All right, folks, we'll see you tomorrow, and if you want to, stick around. I will take your IMs in the post-show, and I tend to rant sometimes in there. Someday we'll integrate maybe both things, but I think we'll also sequester the IMs maybe. So become a member. Ensure that you get the full goodness, and over the weekend we will have our Bush pardon video up, and you will see another benefit to being a member. Why are you laughing about that, Dorsey? That wasn't a joke.
I'm the one who's making the video. I know how funny it is. That's why.
All right. Yes. Let's hope that happens.
Don't piss down my
back. All right. See you later. Stick around for the post show. Between the 101 and the 5, do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the man's up on it. We're back. We are back. This is the post-show show. I take your IMs at Majority Reporter or Majority FM or Cedar MVS or Sam Cedar Show. All the IMs I've collected through the years of taking your IMs. And I will answer your questions. Neffer, good morning. You've seen pictures, pictographs of dinosaurs in Utah. How do you know the bankers are not paying Alex Jones to do what he does already? I don't know that they're not. Julian Assange on Interpol's most wanted list. He's been located but not arrested yet. He's being hunted for exposing the truth. I don't understand what grounds are they. He's not the leaker.
Doesn't he have an outstanding warrant for an unrelated thing?
Oh, is that what it is?
I think he was wanted on like some sort of sexual harassment.
Okay.
Oh.
Rape? Really? That's convenient. Is he? Really? I didn't know that. Huh. Harold says in Jurassic Park they ate their lawyer first. I didn't see it. On the toilet they ate him? Freaking dinosaurs. Hey, Marin did an episode on visiting a creation museum.
Yours is better.
Oh, thank you, Taylor Roth Bell. You know, I would love to do something like that.
We could do that.
But,
Majority Report road trip.
Yeah, how can I arrange that? The only road trip I think I'm allowed to take is to Michigan for the holidays. Cranes flying. Would the Noah's Ark ride at the Creationist be like the pirate ship ride at a normal theme park? That alone would be worth the price of admission. I don't know. Probably, maybe. I imagine it would rock, right, back and forth, and I don't know. Who knows?
It'd smell worse.
It would smell bad. How do you spell MERS? M-E-R-S. Sorry. If essentially anybody can be a MERS, M-E-R-S, VEEP, can someone sign up and start intervening for the good of homeowners? My guess is that no. But I like the way you think, Euros. I can't. I don't understand how people develop some of their IM handles. What do you mean, yeah? Yeah, how can I come up with the most complicated, impossible to pronounce? Hey, check me out on IM. My name is EXL5RF7ZIPPO-RABBIT. No, rabbit. Rabbit. No, not rabbit. You need me to say that again? Non-political question. What's your take on the Steve Martin thing? Do you know what the Steve Martin thing is, Dorsey? Evan does. Apparently, Steve Martin was interviewed by the insufferable Deborah Solomon at the 92nd Street Y. And everybody shows up at the 92nd Street Y, which is sort of a erudite, right? Erudite.
It's cultured.
Am I saying that? It's cultured. I've seen, you know, different talks there, and apparently his new book, is that it? Does he have a new book?
I think so. I
mean, something's out about, like, something to do about art. And so they were asking him about art, and you got a whole crowd of people there to see Steve Martin, and it turns out they weren't interested in hearing him speak about art. And so the audience, somebody sent a note to Deborah Solomon during the thing, and she read it out loud, basically saying, like, the audience doesn't want you to talk about this anymore. And then handed questions from the audience.
It's a new novel. Right. The art world features in it.
And then the subsequent thing was that the 92nd Y sent out like a $50 gift certificate. You know, to like future talks, apologizing for the talk. My opinion is this, having been a part of instances almost identical to this, in other words, really horrible shows that didn't work out, that I was actually a part of, it's, you know, the way it broke down with the audience participating, I didn't find that, that wasn't problematic. I mean, what are you going to do? You can't control the audience. I think it's really inappropriate for a venue to shit on the people they've invited to the venue after the fact. I think it's really inappropriate. You know, if you want to go out and send a coupon to, if you want to send a coupon to all those people, because you have a list of everybody who attended, just send them a coupon. Here, hey, want to appreciate your support? Here's a $50 gift certificate. Don't say we're sorry for the Steve Martin interview. That's offensive. It's rude. You know, those douchebags at TED did that same thing to Sarah Silverman. And it's like, excuse me, if you invite somebody there and they don't deliver what you think they should have delivered, then you fucked up. If I have a guest on my show and that guest is bad, that's my fault. That's not the guest's fault. If that guest shows up and does something different than I thought they were, then I should have told them what my expectations were of them. And if they didn't meet those expectations, I should cancel them. But that's my fuck up. That's not the person I invited to come and perform's fuck up. That's just the way it is. And so I think it's inappropriate by the of the Y to do it's humiliating. It's inappropriate. You know, look, if they allow, I think Steve Martin, you know, tweeted something about just be on guard that they allow the audience to ask questions. You know, look, that shit happens. And you go with it. You roll with it. If the audience is unhappy, what are you going to do? You know, you address the audience. But to send out emails later and saying, we apologize for that interview, you know, here's a $50 gift. Just send them the gift certificate. You don't have to explain it to them. You don't have to make it public. And that douchebag from TED, you know, tweeted like, Sarah Silverman's thing was offensive. What? Oh, my God. Sarah Silverman swears? Are you shitting me? I had no idea. What the fuck? And you know, Ted's got no problem sucking off the cachet of having Sarah Silverman there. It's my Twitter handle spelled backwards. Oh, okay. Well, that makes it much better. Guy whose name I can't pronounce. You still want to tell people who you are, so just come up with another name. I'm so-and-so on Twitter. Or you know what? Let's say your name is Dismopersuru on Twitter. Just say, I'm Dismoperu1 on IM. The Dr. Sachs. Like, that's okay. What's your IM handle? Dr. Sachs. The Dr. Sachs? Yeah. Oh, okay. Glad to hear you back on the show and dig your look on MSNBC. Go ahead, bro. Oh, hey, is the Sammy cam on?
It is. Let me get the audio running. But yeah, it's
on. Okay. Sugar, hi. That was an incredible interview. Oh, well, thank you. Great tip on donating to legal aid societies. Are you aware of any citizens groups working to assist these lawyers and agitate for the interests of the foreclosed? No, but if somebody does know it, send it to me at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we will dig into this. I agree. Well, I do know there is a wheresmynote.com, I think. And it's run by a union where you can ask your bank to see if they have your note, if they actually have it. Avant, 1963. Marin went to the Creation Museum in Kentucky, taped their one humor show about how those know-nothing scientists are to tell our child lies about evolution. It was so bad, but it was great that Marin got on tape. Whole Creation Museum is just trying to get humans and dinosaurs together. If they show drama with humans standing next to a dinosaur, that's proof that it happened. Yes. If you call up Alex Jones and whisper, the fat man walks alone, he'll tell you the secret to life.
We have many miles to go before we sleep. Meet me. Look at the mailbox on 43rd Street and 8th Avenue. If there is a chalk line that has an X next to a chalk outline of a small nun, a nun wearing a habit, will be drawn a chalk. If that is there, take 40 paces to the left, buy 3 slices of pizza with pepperoni on it, and order a small Coke. They will say, we only have Pepsi. Say, I demand a Coke. They will give you a Coke. At the bottom of that Coke cup, there will be a diagram.
Svengali, I have a theory that the modern Republican Party is an avant-garde art piece intended to show the incredibly poor nature of an organization which is consumed by fear, patriotism, and corporatism, and the terrible consequences they should ever be ever elected. That's a good point. Janine had a theory that Ann Coulter was actually Andy Kaufman, and I asked her if she was Andy Kaufman at the Republican National Convention, and she just looked, who's that? Like she didn't know who Andy Kaufman was. But that's available on the Majority Report RNC 2000 DVD, available to our Cedaristas for free.
I just want to say it is not where's my note, it's where's the note. Where's my note lets you track a dollar bill anywhere in the world.
Okay, so where's the note? Although where's my note is also an interesting site, but where's the note is the better one about mortgages. P.S. I'm trying to form a business to offer gold enemas and market it on the Glenn Beck Show. I predict sales to be fantastic. Who says economists don't have... You tell that joke, Svengali says, at the at the Economist faculty get-togethers. I'm trying to remember. I went to a I was a religious studies minor in college, and I went to some religious studies, you know, like they get all the majors and minors. Maybe I was a major. I can't, a dual major or something like that. I can't remember. And we all gathered, and all the religious studies professors would tell these jokes. And I'm trying to think of, like, one of the religious studies jokes was, what's the difference between eschatology and scatology? A priori and a posteriori. Oh. When I became a comedian, and you'd get inevitably, everybody's like, hey, tell me a joke. Tell me a funny joke. That's the joke I would tell them. Like, with a total straight face. Like, and just watch the look on their face. And go, no, it's, I do mostly, like, religious studies conferences, and that fucking joke kills. Yeah, it's, but, which is basically a ripoff of that Steve Martin joke about the, you know, you send me a shank measure. But that was a real joke. Superfunk, Sammy, here's the three policy ideas which I think could profoundly change things. One, publicly funded campaigns. Agree. Two, mail-in voting. Agree. Instant runoff voting. Sort of agree. Publicly funded campaigns is the most important thing. Great job on Oldman. Wish they brought you on for something more serious than the ARC story, but it was good. Wingbeth, fabulous monologue and appreciation for the fact that the new medium allows you to say fuck all. Peaches! Don't be a putz. A corollary of the pretend and extend is the acronym IBGYBG, which stands for I'll be gone, you'll be gone. That's what the bankers are thinking. I get the sense that the politicians think too. Even Barack Obama seems ready to assume the role of ex-president, lining his pockets, flying around, giving speeches Bill Clinton style. You know, I don't think that motivates Obama. I mean, I think he's going to be rich. Of course he's rich. But he was already, you know, like, I just don't think that's what it is. I think there is a, I think he could be in over his head. It's possible. I think it could be that he had to so internalize something as a black person in America to succeed that he is incapable of reaching a point where he can say, you know, enough. And that, because, you know, I'm not even talking, I'm not, that response is not predicated on some belief that he's actually a secret liberal. No, that's, I'm just talking about sheerly political expediency for his own political benefit. You know, we're beyond the realm of he's secretly liberal and he's caving all the time. No, just on a political level, he's caving. He's not even doing himself from a triangulation standpoint any favors by his actions. And it may just be that he is so internalized a mechanism that he needed to internalize to rise to the level that he has as a black person in this country, that he's incapable of, you know, basically standing up and getting mean for his own benefit. Sandy McGee, I can finally, I am. I'm surprised Julian isn't dead yet. Well, really, though? I mean, you'd make him a bit of a martyr, wouldn't you?
It's a little too easy.
I mean, how are you feeling, Sammy? Sounds like you're not on the verge of vomiting anymore, said Optimal Tomatoes. I was off and on okay yesterday. I felt sick at dinner again, and then better. I think it was just sort of like some type of food poisoning. But I'm better. But I dry heaved, and after the show, had a little bit of a an extension of my bodily fluids through my mouth before the show. Dorsey, you missed that.
Thank God.
I was sitting here sort of like spitting into a bucket. I go, Evan, unlock the bathroom door. Open the bathroom door. And just had to run in, like holding my mouth. That would have been ugly. A Assange is wanted for alleged rape, apparently, but the whole case stinks to high heaven. The sex was apparently consensual, but he didn't pull out when the condom broke. The case was previously thrown out, but it was picked up again due in part to pressure from the U.S. There's a story, I'm going to get to this tomorrow, about one of the cables, speaking of U.S. pressure on legal systems, that quashed a couple of investigations in Spain. Maybe we can have Scott Horton on to tell us the story tomorrow. My old buddy Scott Horton. MacMan. Mine is, I'm a Macintosh fan, so I'm MacMan. That makes sense. 851 because I was running Mac OS 851 where I signed up for AIM. All right, well, okay. That's, you know, not necessarily something that, you know, someone else would know. Do you remember what Bob's... No, he's MacMan. Do you remember what operating system he was working on when he signed up for IM? I think, was it... I can't remember. Crystal Count... Oh, Crystal Count. Hey, AP summary, Assange rape case, suspected rape, sexual molestation, unlawful coercion. He's denied the allegations. His lawyer in Britain said Assange had consensual sex. Okay. Said it's an irregular. Has anyone confirmed if you can get MR live on Stitcher? Have we confirmed that?
Not sure about live. I'll give it a shot right now.
I was going to give it a try, but why don't you try it?
I think you guys should race.
Let's have a race.
All right, I'm loading my Stitcher. Let's see. Live. Let's see. Live, 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 live. Loading live. Loading live. Loading live. Loading live. I got to say, though, it's a very convenient way to listen to the podcast. I do both. I download on iTunes because it's also good for our iTunes, what do you call it? Placement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I forget to download. If I want archives, I want download. Now playing. I guess it only seems to have radio stations. Is that right? Why couldn't it just pick up our stream? Hmm? Uh-huh. Why is that? Stitcher? 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 I don't know, Crystal Count, but it's free app, so why not? Xfinity Talk reminded me of Ben Stein and how horrible his anti-evolution movement was. Segment he did in Nazi Gas Chamber. Ugh. Ben Stein. Farmer Jillian, great show, guys. Heard about the brouhaha with the Smithsonian's National Portrait Exhibit? Yes, that was one of the stories I didn't get to. You know what? To quote Bill Donahue in any way, the Catholic League. You know what the Catholic League is? You know how many members of the Catholic League there are? One. Catholic. Bill Donahue. He sits in a fucking office and puts a sign on his door. It says Catholic League. And then he gets invited to go on all these shows. He's a moron. Why should working class play for the leisure of the elite when in fact one of the things the working class like to do is to go professional wrestling? He's talking about, we're sponsored by the Smithsonian. Every single exhibit in the Smithsonian is paid for privately. Public funds just go to operate the place. Moron. Thank you for Happy Hanukkah, Farmer Gillian. Spay F, I don't know if it would ruin us if someone went up against Obama in a primary. It would. But is there any progressive representative out there who could move Obama to the left by threatening to run? Bernie Sanders, no. I was listening on my droid with Stream Furious, having made to go out on the road more enjoyable. I'm glad to hear that, Spaff. I honestly think the only person that could scare Obama to the left is Bloomberg. Why are you looking like that?
No, not you. I'm just looking. Michelle Malkin posted something.
What are you doing? Were you surfing around while we're doing the show?
I'm working the tumblers. That's how I'm looking for links.
Oh, you know what you should do? Go into our thing. What's that guy's name? Reefer Madness guy. Okay. Reefer. Mm-hmm. He's got a couple of songs. Why don't you tell him to put that on Majority Reporter's Tumblr site. Can he put songs on there?
Yeah, you can upload audio. You have to sign up for a Tumblr. Then you need to follow us. We'll follow you back. And then I can reblog whatever comes through the feed.
Right.
That's how we do it.
Right. Because he's got songs that are very lyric-driven that, you know, we just don't, I don't do that. I mean, I play the songs, play the intro, outro songs. This one's about how pot is better than booze. So I'm not questioning the premise. G39, just became a member. Thank you very much. Let's do this then. G39. Thank you, Glenn from Chicago, and happy Hanukkah to you. Jimmy Reefer Cake. There he is. Yes, sir. He just got the mention. He knows it. Jort 36. It's shocking you weren't a successful comedian. Thank you, Josh. That's very kind of you to say. Oh, he didn't. He's referring to my. Yes, I mean, that is a classic. That is sort of a classic Sam Cedar move. Tell me a joke. All right. This joke is essentially my way of saying fuck you to you. Can you help me with my career? I saw Lawrence O'Donnell at MSNBC the other day. I don't even think he's talking to me anymore. I'm not sure if that's true or not. What are you going to do? You know? And then I was like, ah, fuck it. Well, yeah, what am I supposed to do? Like, you know, I did bite my tongue on something the other day, and I can't remember what it was. Oh, I remember what it was. I can't say it now.
And then you're unbiting it.
No, I'm not. Look, there's a couple of things that, like, it's not necessary for me to say. But I say more of it than I should. And generally, the problem is, you know, Marin says this stuff, and, you know, he used to say to, like, you know, the, because I think he also used to do other, like, you know, Marin would shit on the executives, you know, but then he would go down and start talking to them about girls. Whereas I would shit on the executives, and when they would start talking, you know, when they would say anything to me, I'd go, you know, that's offensive. Not that I really thought it was offensive, because I'm not offended by anything. But I'd like to say that because I wouldn't. The problem is I was never friendly to them. I would shit on them, and then I would just shit on them a little bit less. Like, I'm not good at not being honest about, you know. And I went out to dinner the other night with David Bender. It was his birthday. And, you know, just did my best. There were people there who were friends of people that I'm not friends with, that I don't like. Yeah, Mark Green. And, you know, it's like all I could do just like not to, you know, like I don't know these people. I don't know who the people are sitting around the table. It's completely inappropriate for me to just randomly just go like, oh, that guy's a, you know, I'm not saying Mark Green is a douchebag. I'm saying just generically speaking, that guy's a douchebag. And it's completely inappropriate.
You are a douchebag.
But I cannot stop doing that. I try so hard. I really do. I can't afford to do that. I'm getting too old. It's too many bridges I've burned. You realize right now I would be finishing up my ninth, no, or I just finished up my eighth season on According to Jim. If I had just played a little more ball with him. Sam, do you sing? Like on the first time I met him, it was at a table read. You know, I was in the pilot of According to Jim. You guys knew that, right?
No.
You didn't know that?
I did not know that.
I was the, you know, the blonde fat guy?
Yes. I just watched my first episode the other day at the laundromat.
I There are other extraneous factors. So it's not just like self-sabotage, because I was actually, my agent fucked up and didn't know that I should have been on second position, and I had another show, Beat Cops, which I had written and executive produced, that ultimately was produced and I wouldn't have been able to do. But I auditioned for this pilot, and I thought, like, oh, Jim Belushi, this show's never going to go. His shows never get picked up. I'm going to make a buttload of change for, like, 2 weeks' worth of work. I'd done this before, and I was like, I was in. And then I found out you have to sign your contract before you're actually given the job. And I found out I wasn't in second position. I'm like, wait, this is a problem. I don't want to be in first position for this. First position means, like, if it goes, you're held to them. Second position is if it goes, you're held to them only if your first thing falls through. And they hired me, and then the next day they hired Courtney Thorne Smith, who was playing Jim's wife, who I was supposed to be her brother. Now, take a look at me and take a look at Courtney Thorne Smith. And I start to realize, like, holy shit, she's serious, because she just came off of Ally McBeal. And this could go, which was terrifying to me. So we have this table read, like a pre-table read at the executive producer's house. They fly me out to L.A. They put me up at the Chateau Marmont, which is nice. And Belushi's there, who I, you know, like, you know, I'm just thinking, like, I'm going to get a good story out of this, because he's a fucking nut job. And he's like, you got to, do you play any instruments? Nah. Nope. Not at all. Well, do you sing? No. He goes, well, you got to come with me on the road. We're going to have a band in the show that we're going to do. And, like, you don't even need to do anything. Because I got some good musicians behind us. I don't even know how to do anything. We make a ton of money. We go into these corporate gigs and nobody even knows we've done them. We make a ton of money. These guys are really good. And just front them, you know? And I'm like, I don't even like music. And he's like, what? And I go, I think I'm tone deaf. And he says, no, you're not. And he grabs me and he drags me over to a piano. And he starts hitting the piano, going, ding, and I'm just looking at him, and I'm going, like, okay. And he goes, do it. And I'm like, do what? And he goes, bing, and I'm like, he hits the piano, and I go, and he's like, no, just try. And I'm like, and he's like, are you really tone deaf? And I said, yeah, I think so. And then it was just on from there. Like, he wanted me to go to Bakersfield to see his band play. And I'm like, dude, no, I can't do that. And Bakersfield. Yeah, no, it was horrible. And so I realized, like, I've got to get off this show. And so the big joke was that I must have been adopted, because there's no way I could be Courtney Thorne Smith's brother. And so I started to
just like there's no way he would be her husband.
Right. The first scene of the show, or, you know, he takes off his shirt and jumps in bed. Apparently the writers called this the rape scene. and so I put If I Were a Rich Man as my ringer on my phone, and I kept having Benjamin call me on the set so that I would get this thing out, like I would seem more Jewish. And I kept talking like Jackie Stewart, and I would gesticulate. And I'd be like, Jim, I don't understand why you're so mean to me. I'm trying to do that. And the director came up to me and goes, hey, Sam, can I talk to you for a second? Yeah, sure. What's up? Do you feel like you're moving, like you're gesticulating, like you're moving your arms a lot? No, man, that's just my thing. That's the cedar way. And so I bet Benjamin a dinner at Nobu that I would get fired, that it would get picked up and I would get fired. And that's exactly what happened. And I never made it to pass the pilot. But, yeah, you get paid for the pilot. And then I went on to make Beat Cops, so it all worked out. Except for the fact that I didn't make that $10 million that other guy made.
Yes.
But frankly, I would have killed myself. I would have killed myself. Klug, thank you for the video. Please, he's got the countdown appearance. Please send it in an email. That I can understand. Klug sent me, he always sends me emails. I can't make head or tail. One is like a thumbnail creator. I don't even know what that means. But he gave me the HTML code. I'm not sure. I don't even know what to do with it.
We'll figure out something.
Okay. Take a look at it. Bob Flav. Hi, how are you? Oh, great. Thank you very much. That is the mailman. If you're watching on the Sammy Cam, you see the mailman come in. Bob from Las Vegas. Here's an interesting statistic. There are 300 million guns in circulation in the U.S. These people are the greedy corporations, corrupt politicians, bleeding to death. What could possibly go wrong, right? Pluger, where's my jetpack engaged espresso? Somebody is making it, the cover for us, isn't it? Somebody is.
Okay.
I can't remember. I'm confused now. But we'll get there. Parker Spitzer, I'm getting a... oh, yeah. Yeah, there is seems to be something in the paper about Parker being unhappy. I don't know. I'm going to be on the show tonight.
I watched it last night, and...
was she there?
Yeah, she was there, and there was a lot of Spitzer.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. But, I mean, they had Republicans on, so, you know, it was kind of like she sets him up and then throws to him, you know, so...
Mirella, another jerk is the Concerned Women for America representative. I can't remember his name. He's just a single guy representing the group. Bob Knight, maybe. I debated him on Christmas. We're going to play that tomorrow. You told the gesticulating story before, but you never said it was intentional. Hilarious, but sorry you self-sabotaged yourself. I didn't! I didn't self-sabotage myself.
That sounded like self-sabotage, Sam.
Well, I mean, I just don't appreciate the implication that it was unconscious.
No, it seemed like very conscious self-sabotage.
Okay. Oh, there's CNN. I'm doing Parker Spitzer tonight. Taurusy, damn it, PP poll, GOP, Scott Brown in good shape and heavily damn Massachusetts. We'll see about that. All right, folks, we've gone over. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there.